fluctuating space-time foam. And there's actually a tiny probability that every once in a while that quantum space-time fluctuation will pop into existence of virtual particles. Now, we call them virtual particles because the laws of quantum mechanics tell us they have to return to the space-time quantum foam in a time period that's briefer than our possibility of being able to measure the appearance of a virtual particle or actually being able to keep one and study it in a lab. So they're not like particles that we can build stuff out of. They're particles that pop into existence and pop out of existence before we can measure them or use them. On the other hand, there are experiments in physics that tell us that this is actually going on. Particularly the physics of black holes tells us this must be a pervasive phenomena in the universe. But the thing that Hawking is overlooking, and many of his peers are overlooking, is the probability of getting a quantum fluctuation with an event coming out of it, like a virtual particle being produced, is proportional to the passage of time. The greater the passage of time, the greater the probability that you're going to get a quantum event. But it was Hawking's own space-time theorems that proved that the universe can be traced back to the beginning of space and time itself. And so time didn't always exist. It came into existence at the beginning of the universe. But if you're going to claim the universe was created by quantum space-time fluctuation, well, the probability of getting a quantum event is proportional to the passage of time, and if there's a zero passage of time, there's a zero probability. Therefore, quantum mechanics cannot be the answer to how the universe came into existence because it requires time. And the beginning of the universe is the beginning of time. And so that rules that out. But as what's really motivating Stephen Hawking is that he wants to find a theory of everything, whereas he said back in 1988 in A Brief History of Time, if we find this complete theory of physics, then we would know the mind of God. We would know everything that God would know. Well, the standard models of the universe limit how much we human beings can learn about the universe, let alone everything else. And that's one reason why I think Hawking has rejected the standard models, because they limit the possibility of human investigation. But as the Bible points out, only God knows everything. And that's going to be true in the new creation just as much as in this creation. In the new creation, we humans will know a lot more, but we'll never know everything. Only God is omniscient, knowing everything. And the physics of the universe tells us that indeed we can't know everything. In fact, it was Kurt Gödel that pointed out the incompleteness theorem, that if you do not have complete information about a system, and if you're within that system, you can never get complete information in that system, therefore you can never develop a complete theory. Only a being that exists beyond the space-time dimensions of the universe would ever have the potential to learn all the data about the universe. And by that means alone, we human beings can never achieve a theory of everything. We can never gain the mind of God.
A 15-year-old skeptic asked me a question this week, and I tried my best to answer, and I was not even satisfied with my answer. So I'm hoping you might be able to help me. He was questioning the time, place, and arrangement of the Old Testament, and he gave me his theory, and I honestly wasn't able to debate it well. Like, for instance, the book of Genesis and some of the earlier books, how were they written? When did they all come into an arrangement together? His theory is that some wealthy emperor or king or something paid his wise men, or you know, had wise men to just write the whole thing and con people into believing that all of them came about in different centuries and different ages into one book called the Bible. So I'd love to have some ammunition to take back.
Well, that's a good question. It's a question that's been asked for hundreds of years. Because as you go through the Old Testament, you won't see this in the New Testament. The New Testament is relatively chronological, but the Old Testament is not. The chronology jumps back and forth. And so people have asked why. Well, what the ancient Hebrews did in putting together the Old Testament is they pulled together the 39 books of the Old Testament into three collections of books. And so you have at the beginning of our typical English Bible the historical books, and then they're followed by the poetic books, which are followed by the prophetic books. And each of those sets of books is in a chronological order. So all the historical books are chronologically ordered. All the poetic books are chronologically ordered. And all the prophetic books are chronologically ordered. But for example, the first of the poetic books predates the first of the historical books. So Genesis is not the earliest text we see in the Bible. Rather, Job is the earliest text that we see in the Bible. And so, yeah, you can expect the chronology to jump when you move from the historical books to the poetic books, and likewise when you move from the poetic books to the prophetic books. But there is a strict chronology, if you understand those three separate groupings. But it really helps us, for example, understand what's going on with Genesis 1. Because in Genesis 1, Moses leaves out a lot of critical creation content. The reason he did that is that Job had already laid it out. And Job predates the book of Genesis by at least 400 years. Some people think 600 or 700 years. And so that data was already out there in the people's general knowledge. And so basically Genesis 1 supplements what's already in the Job creation accounts. So maybe that will help. And in terms of the New Testament, it's fairly chronological, although some people argue the Gospel of Mark predates the Gospel of Matthew. There's some good textual evidence that that's the case. But the first three Gospels predate John. John's the last of the Gospels, later the Gospels, and then you move into the epistles that you see in the book of Romans, the book of Acts, and Romans forward. So, okay.
Alright, my question is, how does the definition or the collapsing of black holes fit into fine tuning?
How do black holes fit into fine tuning? Well, they fit into fine tuning in that they are an artifact of what's called the cosmic density. So the greater the density...
No, you misunderstand.
Okay.
At a certain point, and black holes on it, when it no longer it explodes on two axes, how does that fit into fine
tuning? Okay, let me see if I've heard you right. Are you talking about the transition from a black hole to a white hole or something else?
The way I heard it, it's kind of described it explodes along one axis at both ends, and it's either dissipates or shrinks.
Okay, two possibilities. They may be talking about a wormhole, which is two black hole singularities coming together and forming a tube, where you get one space-time realm at one end of the mouth and a different space-time at the end of the other. Or they may be talking about these supergiant galaxies that have a supermassive black hole in their core, and beyond the gravitational pull of the black hole, you get these radio lobes that jet out lots of energy. So, do you know which one it is?
No.
I can explain both if you want me to.
Alright, do both.
Alright, do both. Okay. Well, have you ever watched, what's that science fiction series on TV? Babylon 5, and then there's another one, where Stargate, yeah, where they take advantage of a wormhole. And so it explains how you get around the limitations of the space-time physics of the universe, is if you've got a wormhole, you can take your spaceship through the wormhole and come out in a completely different space-time situation. You can go back in time, forward in time, and you can go through space much more rapidly than the velocity of light. Well, it makes a nice story for television, and mathematically, it's actually possible, but physically, it's impossible. Because in order to set up that kind of a wormhole, you need a black hole here and a black hole here, where you have a singularity of one black hole, singularity of another black hole, and then mathematically they join perfectly together, where the singularity of black hole A perfectly lines up with the singularity of black hole B. If that's the case, it forms a wormhole, where you can travel from one space-time realm to another space-time realm. We claim it's physically impossible because the probability that the two singularities lining up perfectly is zero. And even if they did line up perfectly, the longevity for the wormhole measures to be zero, so it can't last any significant period of time. And you're certainly not going to be able to travel through the wormhole, because as you enter a black hole, the gravity gets greater and greater, and what that gravity does, you're about 6 feet tall, it will stretch all the protons and neutrons in your body out into a single line about 3 or 4 miles long. That's the first thing that happens. That all happens before you reach the event horizon, but as you approach the event horizon, all the particles that are lined up in this long, 4 mile long line get destroyed. And as you go through, they're not going to be rebuilt. And that's because the thermodynamics of the universe is so high that there are many mechanisms in the physics of the universe that are irreversible. That's one reason why the universe can have only one beginning, because the entropy of the universe would only permit one beginning. And so you can't reverse the expansion of the universe, but neither can you reverse the process of what happens when you enter into the maw of a black hole. Now, we can rule that out, and I got more detail on that in my book over there, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, where we talk about wormholes. But what is legitimate is the idea that a supermassive black hole can develop bipolar jets. We see that in lots of large galaxies. Probably the closest galaxy where we see that is Centaurus A, where it's got a supermassive black hole. And what that does, because the galaxy is rotating, you've got this supermassive black hole that's sucking matter and gas into it, and that sets up these highly charged particles moving at relativistic velocity, which basically forms big balloons of relativistic charged particles, and we get to see the radiation signal coming out of that. And how that fits in is you need to be a long ways away from that kind of a galaxy, because that lobe-generated structure by the supermassive black hole is going to sterilize light anywhere within its vicinity. But fortunately, we're far enough away from galaxies that behave that way that we can all live without any worries or concerns about that kind of phenomena happening. But that was my research study when I was at the University of Toronto, of looking at those kinds of galaxies. And it was exciting because that was the one place we could go in astrophysics and really learn in great detail the physics of synchrotron radiation and inverse Compton radiation. At least at that time, 30 years ago, that was really the only place we could go to study those kinds of phenomena. So I'm glad God put a few of them relatively close enough that we could study them.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm trying to figure out Stephen Hawking's psychology. It's obvious from what you've done read that the law of thermodynamics is irreversible. I mean, the second law goes on and on. How on earth can he get around the fact that complex organisms develop when nature does everything it possibly can to bring complex to simpler? Am I missing something here? Is the guy really off his rocker?
Well, I wouldn't say he's off his rocker, but what you'll see in Corinthians, Paul wrote about the body of believers. He says, not many among you are wise by the world's standards. And something I observed when I was on the faculty at Caltech is that when you're around people that rank highest in brilliance of the human population, they also tend to rank highest in pride and human hubris. And so you get people like Hawking actually believing that he can know as much as God knows, and actually seriously pursue those kinds of disciplines. I was shocked to discover that there was a Nobel laureate at Caltech who was doing private research on occult physics because he wanted to try to discover something about physics that his peers weren't onto at all. And so these very brilliant people wind up doing foolish things because they have the wrong worldview. But I think where Hawking is coming from in that point, and see, a friend of mine at Caltech actually lived in his home for 4 years and had daily discussions with him on these kinds of issues. And his comment is that, from his perspective, Hawking did not want to answer to a higher authority. And not wanting to answer to a higher authority, he was unwilling to give God the credit for creating all the different species of life on planet Earth, because if he gave him that kind of credit, then that means that that God would be intimately concerned about his creatures and would be exercising authority over those creatures. And so, yeah, your worldview does color the way you do your science.
Is there anyone addressing the thermodynamic problem of life?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there are people doing significant research on whether or not thermodynamics is going to permit genetic advance. Research tells us that thermodynamics operates at a genetic level. It does degrade the information over time. The deleterious mutations far overwhelm the beneficial mutations, and therefore the genome of every creature with respect to time decays rather than advances. And as we study our own genome, it appears that the human genome is probably at the top of experiencing the most rapid decay. For that reason alone, I have argued in my books that God will be bringing about the end of all evil and suffering relatively quickly, if for no other reason that our genome is decaying at such a rapid rate. He's got to speed things up. Otherwise, we'll be gone before evil is removed.
Thank you.
I'd like to get a better understanding of how you and Reasons to Believe approach hermeneutic of the Bible when you study and draw conclusions and compare.
Give me that word again.
Hermeneutic?
Oh, hermeneutic.
Yes.
Got it. Okay.
I think that's the right word. For example, what I understand so far of how you approach study of the Bible and extracting truth from it is that first you begin with the premise that it is 100% true and without error, inerrant, and the task is to find out what does everything mean. And if one most obvious example is the 6 days of creation, whether that's meant to be taken figuratively or literally, and obviously you take the position that it's literal if you understand the meaning of the Hebrew words in one of their allowed interpretations. So what I'm getting at is, under what circumstances would you think that a reading is to be taken figuratively? And can you give me some examples?
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. I mean, 25 years ago, we did a 7-year class on the book of Revelation. And the book of Revelation is filled with figures and symbols. And so the first question we dealt with is, how do we know what's figurative and symbolic and what is not? And what we did at the beginning of that class is actually go through all 66 books of the Bible with special attention on the 39 Old Testament books and say, what pattern do we see here in the way these other books treat figures and symbols? And what we discovered, took us about 6 months to do this, is that the Bible will use symbols only if the symbols are defined within the Bible, but it might be defined in another book. So to give an example from the book of Revelation, right there in chapter 1, it defines stars as a symbol, and basically says the stars are angels. And so as you read through the book of Revelation, there are passages where stars are literally stars, like we astronomers study. But other places where it refers to stars, and it's meant to be used as a symbol for angels. But we don't have to say, are they helicopters? Because that's nowhere defined in the Bible. And so our whole point is the symbols are consistently defined within the text. And if you don't find a simple definition, then you have to take it literally. You can't take it symbolically. And with respect to figures of speech, the figures likewise are defined within the Bible. You know, I'm finishing up a book now on the book of Job, and you know, one of the big controversies in liberal theology has been the idea that Moses presumed that the sky was a metallic vault with little holes in it through which rain would fall, and based that on the fact that you see in the book of Job chapter 37 a reference to the sky being like a brass mirror. And so what's going on there? Is that literal or is that figurative? Well, that's, I think, the 27th verse of chapter 37. If you read three verses further down, you see that it defines it as a figure of speech, making the point that after the rain has fallen and the wind has swept the sky clear, and now the sky is completely clear, and that's when you get the clearest sky, after a rainstorm and a strong wind. It says the sky will be so bright, it will be like looking at a polished brass mirror with a light being reflected in it. And a polished brass mirror was the most reflective surface that the ancients had. They had no other more reflective surface than polished brass. And but the whole point is, I mean, just to think of looking at a mirror with a bright light behind you, it will hurt your eyes to look at that mirror. Likewise, Job is making the point that if you look at the sky after the rain has stopped and the wind has blown it completely clear, you will hurt your eyes as you look up at the sky. And you can try that as an experiment, you know, just see what it's like. Here in Los Angeles, usually the sky is sufficiently dense that it's not a problem to look up at the sky. But after the rain has fallen, the wind has swept it clear, you will hurt your eyes if you look up at the sky. It's just that bright. So that's an example where people were thinking it was literal, where in the Bible, the figure of speech was defined as a figure of speech.
And which book was that?
That was the book of Job, chapter 37. That's probably one of the more controversial places in the text where people argue, is this literal or is it figurative? But again, if you read the whole, and you know, the secret there is you have to read the Bible in context. You know, just like we started that class by saying, we need to look at all 66 books to answer this question. We can't just look at one book. Same principle we use in science. When we develop a principle in science, it's got to match what we see in all the scientific disciplines, not just the narrow discipline in which I have my PhD.
So you would understand the explanation of the symbology to be internal to that book. Not
it's internal.
So not between Job and Chronicles or something like that.
Right. Oh, well, just to be clear, for example, in the book of Revelation, it refers to the Antichrist coming up out of the seas. Now, that's not defined in the book of Revelation, but in the book of Isaiah, it tells us the seas are the unbelieving Gentile nations. So it's not saying that the Antichrist is going to walk up from the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. Rather, he's going to come from the unbelieving Gentile nations. That's an example where a symbol is defined in the Bible, but not in the book. You have to go to a different book to find a definition. And for most of the symbols in the book of Revelation, they're defined elsewhere in the Bible, not in the book itself. John is presuming that you're intimately familiar with all the Old Testament books. And so he doesn't bother to define the symbols because those Old Testament authors already did that for you. Which is why when people ask me to teach on the book of Revelation, I said we're going to have to cover at least one-third of the Bible's books in great detail, because that's where all the symbols are defined.
Somebody asked me, again, where Adam and Eve were made first. Was it near the Tigris and Euphrates, etc.? So what I need to define is we were watching something, some whole thing on the migration of people, and they said that the first people were in Namibia and went up. So if were Adam and Eve black, were they, you know, were they, Namibia's over here somewhere, it's not up near the Tigris and Euphrates, So I need help.
Okay. Well, for you, those of you who are not familiar with your African geography, India is a nation just to the north of South Africa, and it's on the west coast of South Africa. And that's one of the places in Africa where they see great genetic diversity amongst the people living there. But likewise, you see very high diversity in Ethiopia, you see it in Kenya, you see the nations on the eastern side, just north of South Africa. So there's a lot of debate where we find the greatest genetic diversity. But one thing we do know is the sub-Saharan black peoples manifest the greatest genetic diversity of the entire human species. In fact, what's interesting is there's more similarity between Asians and Europeans than there is between certain black tribes and other black tribes of sub-Saharan Africa. But there have been anthropologists who pointed out that this increased diversity may simply be an artifact of culture. Because what we notice with the sub-Saharan black tribes is they've had a long history of not interbreeding. So, for example, when Stanley went into the Belgian Congo to do missionary work 150 years ago, he observed that there were tribes of pygmies that were 3.5 feet tall, living just a few miles from tribes of giants that were 7 feet tall, and they would not intermarry with one another. Whereas the habit of the Europeans and the Asians was to have fairly aggressive intermarriage. And so the fact that these tribes maintained their little tribal ethnic group with such rigidity by itself would explain why you had greater genetic diversity in the sub-Saharan peoples. And then people are trying to use the genetic diversity as a tool for locating the origin of the first man and first woman, are doing so on the presumption that human beings are random migrators. But the genetic evidence itself tells us that that's not true. But the genetic evidence tells us that there was a period of time when humans remained in one place. Then there was a brief period where there was extremely aggressive migration, and then the migration ceased. Well, if that's the case, then simply looking at the greatest genetic diversity won't give you any information at all. In fact, you know, my colleague Fuzz Rana points out that given that humans are not random migrators, all the genetic evidence tells us is that the first humans came from within 2,000 or 3,000 miles of the juncture of Africa, Asia, or Europe. The error bars are much larger than what certain people will state on PBS documentaries. So with that in mind, you really can't pin down the location of the Garden of Eden or where the first man and first woman lived simply by looking at modern-day genetic data. Where you can get a clue is from this book, because it tells us that the first man, the first woman, lived in a location, the Garden of Eden, where four rivers come together. It's the Tigris, the Euphrates, the Gihon, and the Pishon. And thanks to satellite imagery, we now know the location of the Pihon and the Gishon, namely that they're big rivers that were big during the days at the end of the last ice age. Today, they're dry riverbeds because all the snow and ice on the mountains nearby has long ago melted. But if you go back 30, 40, 50,000 years, those were major rivers. And we can still see today the riverbeds of these two rivers. They flow through southern Arabia and flow into the Persian Gulf. Well, likewise, the Tigris and the Euphrates, which are still major rivers, flow into the Persian Gulf. The Tigris and Euphrates flows into the northwestern part of the Persian Gulf. The Pihon and the Gishon flow into the southwestern part of the Persian Gulf. But if you kind of push those rivers forward into the Persian Gulf, they all meet together in one location in the southwestern part of what now is the Persian Gulf. But there's also geological evidence that tells us the Persian Gulf was dry towards the end of the last ice age. So our model for the Garden of Eden is that it's not in Mesopotamia. It is now in what is the Persian Gulf. And that with the close of the last ice age, the Persian Gulf filled up with water. In fact, our model for the Genesis flood is an event that filled all of the Persian Gulf, a large portion of southern Arabia, and all of Mesopotamia. So we have the biggest old earth creationist flood model.
So they weren't black, they were brown.
Well, answering that question, what color were they?
Yes.
There's recent evidence that would suggest that they were black.
Okay.
But it's disputed evidence. It has to do with whether or not there was a brief episode of limited interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals. Some evidence indicates that that did take place. Other evidence suggests that maybe it did not take place. But if it did take place, it would explain the racial diversity of the human species, because that's been a big enigma. How can you explain a human species having such distinct racial separation, where you've got the blacks living in one place, the browns living in another place, the whites living in another place, and apparently it's got nothing to do with evolutionary pressure, because some of the dark-skinned people live up in the Arctic, and you've got white-skinned people that are living near the tropics. So there's really no environmental pressure to explain the racial distinctives. But if there was a brief interbreeding episode between the Neanderthals and the humans, it could possibly explain the racial distinctives. Why? Because we notice that Europeans and Asians have more genetic similarity with Neanderthals than do the sub-Saharan blacks. And what that would suggest is that the first man and the first woman were black, and the racial distinctives are an artifact of this episode where there was this brief interbreeding. Now, it's extremely brief. In fact, the researchers point out, if it's real, it's a level of bestiality that ranks lower than the level of bestiality we observe today in the human species. And in terms of it affecting the image of God, it would have no effect at all, because the interbreeding content was quickly wiped out. But what we do notice is that where the racial similarity, where the genetic similarity is strongest between Asians and Europeans and Neanderthals as opposed to sub-Saharan blacks, over half of that genetic distinctive has to do with skin color. So it's a suggestion. More research will tell us whether or not that is a correct explanation or not.
So we can say Adam and Eve might have been black, but Jesus was brown?
Oh, the color of Jesus is another whole issue. There's really no genetic tool we have to answer that question, but there's a possibility we might be able to figure out the color of the first humans. So we'll see.
Thank you.
You brought up this, talking about the cataloging of all these planets that we've discovered, and Hawking's, you know, how that's possibly changed his view and things. When I've been asked about this, and I want to make sure the assumption is correct, I would say even in that catalog, if you came up with a whole bunch of planets that actually were similar to our Jupiters and similar to our Earth, that doesn't change the RTB model or our view of the universe, because we talk about the book Rare Earth. It really should be Rare Earth, Rare Sun, Rare Solar System, Rare Galaxy, on and on. Because obviously our sun, I think, is obviously the most unique sun that we've found. We haven't found any stars similar to our sun. So even if we found an Earth and some other large gas giants, if you don't have a sun that's identical to ours, wouldn't that obviously show that obviously you wouldn't have another planet possibly with advanced life on it?
No, you're right. I mean, what we're promoting at Reasons to Believe is what's called the Rare Earth or Unique Earth Doctrine. Our model will hold up if the characteristics of Earth prove to be rare as opposed to being completely unique, because you're right. You need everything to line up. So, for example, if you had, say, one planet out of a million that had the characteristics of Earth, that does not discount the fact that God was responsible for supernaturally designing the Earth. Because because you might have one part in a million to get just the right kind of star, and there's all kinds of one parts in a million you've got to put all together. So it doesn't have to be exactly unique to prove the doctrine of God's supernatural design of the system for advanced life. I mean, our current list of characteristics that must be fine-tuned to make advanced life possible, just fine-tuning on the cosmological bodies adds up to over 900. So there's 900 separate things you have to fine-tune. And none of them have to be unique. They simply have to be rare. Now, as it turns out, that the evidence is telling us it's unique. We don't see any stars that have the qualities of the sun that would permit a planet to orbit about it that could support advanced life. We don't see any planets that are like Jupiter, which manifests the characteristics which permit another planet in the same system that could have advanced life. And actually what we now know, thanks to the discovery of these extrasolar planets, is all eight of the planets in our solar system must be fine-tuned in their characteristics to make life possible here on planet Earth. So Thanksgiving is coming up in a couple of months' time. One thing you might do at Thanksgiving is thank God for Uranus and Neptune and Jupiter and Saturn and Venus and Mars, how they're all fine-tuned to make life possible here on planet Earth and to make it possible for us to enjoy Thanksgiving dinner. That's what we do when we celebrate Thanksgiving in our household. So we also thank them for the bacteria and the viruses and a few other things too. So does that answer the question?
Yeah, it does. And obviously, by the time you put all those characteristics together, it truly makes for an advanced life a miracle. Because every time you add one characteristic, the odds obviously just get totally astronomical.
Right.
Even with the size, age of the universe, the odds of having a planet such as Earth, it winds up being a miracle.
It's also a testable hypothesis in the sense that if you're saying God is responsible for these characteristics, that means you would anticipate, as we learn more about our galaxy and our solar system, about the Earth, the evidence for the rare Earth doctrine will grow stronger rather than weaker. Whereas the one who's saying that it's all happening through natural process would have to argue it's going to go the opposite direction, that the evidence will get weaker, the characteristics will get less, the fine-tuning will get less. So in that sense, if someone you're talking to is not convinced today, you can say, well, let's wait 30 days and see whether the evidence gets stronger or weaker. And I can tell you this, this field is advancing so fast, you only need to wait 30 days. In fact, if you subscribe to New Reasons to Believe, it's free on our website, you'll see the evidence gets stronger every week for God being responsible for designing our planetary system and galaxy for the benefit of life.
Would you agree that obviously it's been amazing, some of the atheist scientists that talking about the anthropic principle, that it seemed as if the universe knew we were coming. Have you seen this also, that more scientists are at least admitting to the fact that the universe knew that we were coming?
That's a growing consensus in the astronomical and physical community, is that when we look at the characteristics of the universe, you can't avoid concluding that, to quote the atheist physicist Freeman Dyson, the universe must have known that we were coming. It was designed in advance for our benefit. Or there's no avoiding the conclusion that there's a God out there that designed everything with us in mind 14 billion years later. What is still being disputed is whether we can extend that to the biological realm. Now, I would argue that in addition to a cosmological anthropic principle, there's also a biological anthropic principle, but that's more challenging because biology is orders of magnitude more complex than astronomy is, and the difference, too, is in biology we do not have complete data sets. The fossil record is still, or pardon me, the catalog of species on planet Earth is still only about 25% to 30% complete. Whereas we've got a rather big catalog, relatively complete, of a different kind.
In your book, Creator and the Cosmos, you stated in regard to exotic matter, in contrast to ordinary matter, that there were something like 23 subparticles be slightly off on that, around that kind of number. And at that time, in the book, he said they had not yet actually been detected. They were logically deduced, mathematically and otherwise. And I'd like to know, since that publication, which is a number of years ago, have any of the exotic particles actually been detected?
Okay. Yeah, what I wrote in The Crater in the Cosmos is that physicists had come up with 38 different candidate exotic particles. These were possible particles that could explain the existence of the exotic matter, which is six times more plentiful than the ordinary matter. And of those 38, only one had been identified, and that would be neutrinos. And we've now identified three different flavors of neutrinos. So we got three that have been identified. There's evidence that's tantalizingly close to being positively confirmed that there are sterile neutrinos. These are neutrinos that don't interact with photons at all, whereas the ordinary neutrinos have a very weak interaction with photons. A recent issue of the Astrophysical Journal came up with a three standard deviation detection of sterile neutrinos. But in order to convince the skeptics, because what three standard deviation means is you're 99% certain you've made a positive detection. But nobody in physics will believe it until you got five standard deviations, which means there's less than one chance in 10,000 that you're wrong. So there's still a 1% chance that we're wrong. But that's the closest we've come to detecting another kind of exotic matter particle. Two others that are potentially detectable would be axions and neutralinos. And axions are where we're quite close. In fact, most astrophysicists believe that axions make up most of the exotic matter that's out there, a little more than 50%. And there's a race between the Large Hadron Collider particle physicists and astronomers that are looking at the cooling sequences of white dwarfs to see who will be the first to discover the axion. And whoever discovers the axion first almost certainly will win the Nobel Prize. So, but if it's the Large Hadron Collider team, 10,000 people will share the prize. So, we have found three different kinds of neutrinos, and there's a good possibility we're on the verge of discovering a fourth kind of neutrino, and then I would say maybe even within the next year we might nail down that sterile neutrino, but we're probably 3 to 5 years off of detecting the axions. So maybe sooner. I'll keep you abreast. I mean, I'm kind of watching the literature to see who's ahead, the white dwarf people or the Large Hadron Collider people. Right now, it looks like the white dwarf guys have an advantage. So we'll see. But there are other candidates as well, but those are the ones we got the best shot at making relatively early detection. They're not actually detected yet. Say the best we've got is a three standard deviation detection of the sterile neutrino. We don't even have that yet for the axion. On the other hand, there are astronomers that are collecting data on really old white dwarfs that are on the verge to making detection. So we'll see. That's on the presumption, of course, that we're right that axions are the dominant component of exotic dark matter. If we're wrong on that one, all this is not going to happen. Yes.
What are your thoughts on dark matter?
What are my thoughts on dark matter? Well, there are two different kinds, as you just heard us discussing. There's ordinary dark matter, and then there's exotic dark matter. And at least 90% of the ordinary matter, that's matter made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons, is what we call dark. The only way you're going to see through telescopes the ordinary matter is if they collapse into very dense bodies like stars. And then when that happens, they ignite nuclear fusion and they shine with very bright light. And so when you look at stars and galaxies, you're seeing that small part of the ordinary matter that's condensed enough that it's emitting light. But the evidence tells us that at least 90% of the ordinary matter has scattered throughout the universe in very tiny packages where there's no possibility of them emitting light. So then how do you detect them? We detect them by their gravitational influence. We were talking earlier about these missing baryons. How we measure how many baryons are missing is we look at the dynamics of bodies going around the big galaxies. That will give us a measure of the dark stuff that's hidden from view through our optical telescopes or the gravitational lenses. But there's six times as much exotic matter as there is ordinary matter. So what's the difference? Ordinary matter, given the opportunity, will strongly interact with light. Exotic matter is the opposite. There's either a weak or a zero interaction with light. And so, for example, we're talking about the detection of neutrinos. That's exotic matter. But a neutrino can go through the entire planet Earth without interacting with anything. Neutrinos in the billions are going right through your body, and they're not disturbing any of the proteins in your body. But because these neutrinos weakly interact with light, every once in a while, they will make an interaction with ordinary matter in such a way that it'll emit light. So one of the ways we detect neutrinos is we build a huge detector with, say, 10,000 tons of water, surrounded by photomultipliers, photodetectors, and we look for those very rare episodes where the neutrino will actually interact with light in such a way that we see them. But typically you have to observe for 3, 5, 10 years before you get a handful of detections that will tell you anything about the properties of those neutrinos. And those are the easy ones to detect. The ones we've been talking about, the axions, neutralinos, and the sterile neutrinos, are far more difficult to detect than these tau electron neutrinos that we see coming out of the sun. But the quantity of the ordinary matter and the exotic matter must both be fine in cosmic history. If it expands too quickly, you won't get stars and planets forming. If it expands too slowly, all you get are black holes. And you have to very carefully fine-tune it, literally to better than one part in a quadrillion, 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 in order to get stars and planets of the right type forming at the right time in cosmic history where you can have advanced life existing. And moreover, you also have to fine-tune the location of these different kinds of matter. In order to have life, the ordinary matter has to highly condense, and the exotic matter must not condense but form more diffuse halos. And so, for example, when we look at our Milky Way galaxy, the ordinary matter we see adds up to about 200 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. But surrounding our galaxy is a much bigger halo of exotic dark matter. And so the total mass of our galaxy, just in terms of the near vicinity of our galaxy, only going out, say, 200,000 light years, adds up to 700 million times the mass of our star, the Sun. But there's much more exotic matter beyond that again. And it takes a huge halo of exotic dark matter to stabilize the spiral structure of our galaxy. And so there's a halo of ordinary dark matter around our galaxy, an even bigger halo of exotic dark matter, and it takes both halos with exactly the right mass, with exactly the right kind of triaxial configuration in order to get the kinds of spiral arms that are critical for advanced life to exist. So that's something else you can thank God for at Thanksgiving, is the fact that we have just exactly the right quantity of exotic dark matter particles distributed in exactly the right kinds of halos with the right geometric shapes to make it possible for us to enjoy our dinner. Go ahead.
Yeah, a couple of things. First of all, looking at the universe, like your picture you got there, it seems to me like it's chaotic. Everything is random chance. There's particles pop in and out. I don't see how you can say that it's finely tuned for anything. I think your book is a little premature, since the universe is, 178 billion light years or something across? And there might be some little corner that we haven't looked at yet that has, you know, planets like ours or other life. So that's a statement. However, I'd like to get back to anthropology about Mara's question there. I was reading a book called We Are All Africans, in which states that we came out of Africa and we spread out all over the world. And that's genetically proven and anthropology proven and fossils proven. One of the things that was very interesting is that the fossil record indicates that as recently as 30,000 years ago, at least four different types of hominins lived on this planet. That was Homo erectus, Neanderthal, Floresiensis, and Homo sapiens. And Homo sapiens. So there was three other hominins that lived at the same time that we did. So that's three distinct species of humans. So that begs the question, how can anyone imagine that we had been especially created if other three types of other humans lived alongside of us, our own ancestors?
All right. Well, our species is not Homo sapiens. Our species is Homo sapiens sapiens.
Right.
And so these hominid species that in some cases overlap the existence of our species all together are called Homo sapiens. So it's simply an arbitrary term that's been applied to ape-like creatures that have a bipedal walking behavior.
Hominins is that
right.
What they call them.
And there's really no evidence that tells us that Homo erectus existed at the same time that humans existed. The only undisputed evidence we have goes back 200,000 years. So Homo erectus, 1.8 million to 200,000 years ago. Some people have speculated they may go back as far as 2 million years ago. And there are those who speculated that Homo erectus gave rise to Homo forensis. So that's where the speculation comes from, that Homo erectus overlapped human beings. It's not based on any evidence.
They seem to have evidence genetically and fossils.
No, there are no fossils of Homo erectus that date any more recent than 200,000 years.
No, this is 30,000 years or so.
Well, okay, that evidence is Homo forensis. And yeah, we do have, in fact, Homo forensis existed up until 18,000 years ago. But Homo forensis much more was like a chimpanzee than a human, 3.5 feet tall, and the brain was only very slightly larger than that of a chimpanzee, which means that the cranial capacity of Homo forensis was 1/4 that of a human being. So a much smaller brain. And we have no evidence that they developed any kind of a culture, even tool use.
Well, that's our ancestors. And you can say, why were they alongside of us when we were created specially? I mean, you know,
well,
by God.
Okay, there's another book there that I'll buy for you. It's called Who Was Adam? And what you'll see in Who Is Adam is, yes, these species did exist, but there's no gradual progression in bipedal capability or cranial capacity. And particularly when you look at the cranial capacity, it's quantum step functions. And so we'll see a cranial capacity of 400 cubic centimeters, and it doesn't change with respect to time. It stays at 400 cubic centimeters for that species. Then that species disappears. So it'd be like Homo forensis, and then you've got Homo erectus that comes in at 800. But from 1.8 million years ago to 200,000 years ago, it stays at 800. There's no change in the cranial capacity. So for 1.6 million years, zero evolution. And then you have Neanderthals and humans coming in at 1,600 cubic centimeters. But then when you compare the brains of Homo erectus, Neanderthals with that of humans, they're roughly the same size. although the human brain is much bigger than the Neanderthal brain relative to body size. And what really determines what you can do with your brain is what's called the encephalization quotient. What counts is not the size of your brain, but the size of your brain relative to the size of your body. Now that should make all of you women here feel a little bit better, because female brains are smaller than male brains, but the encephalization ratio is about the same, because female bodies are not as big as male bodies. Matter of fact, us men have bigger brains because we have a greater muscle ratio than females do, and it takes brain matter to sustain those muscles. So it doesn't mean that we men are better at philosophy and mathematics than women are. It just means that our brains are partitioned a little differently. And when you compare Neanderthal brains with human brains, the partitioning difference is enormous. Because what you notice is the human brain has a very large parietal lobe, which allows us to engage in meditation, philosophy, and mathematics, but at a considerable cost. Neanderthals had much more brain matter to sustain the nose. We humans have a terrible sense of smell, and that's because God did not want to waste our brain power on smelling things. Rather, he wanted us to be able to play this piano concerto, to type 100 words a minute on our computer, and to engage in tensor calculus and all kinds of other fun activities. So he gave us brains that could do all that. But the amazing thing is that we humans survived. We were having to compete with the Neanderthals, who were much stronger than we were. They could run faster than we could. They were much more survivable in that their bodies were built so they wouldn't lose a lot of heat. They were much more compact bodies. And they had, you know, a very good sense of smell, probably better eyesight and better hearing, which means they could outcompete us in basic survival. However, God's intent was that we would survive, and what happened is that humans very quickly replaced the Neanderthals. Why? Because we developed technology almost immediately and began wearing clothes. Because where Neanderthals really had a huge advantage over us is their ability to survive in a cold climate. Because they had very short arms, short legs, a barrel-shaped chest, which means that they would lose a lot less heat to their environment than the skinny, tall humans that were running around with them. But the evidence tells us Neanderthals did not wear clothes. They lacked the brain capacity to develop technology. And the proof of that is Neanderthals were here from 150,000 years ago to 30,000 years ago. And until humans showed up, there was no advance in their tool use technology. It was stagnant throughout the entire time. Now, there is some evidence it became slightly more advanced when humans showed up on the scene. But I would argue that's really no different than what happens when you go to Africa and the monkeys steal your stuff. You know, I've been to Africa 3 times. I've been to Japan several times. And in both places, monkeys have this habit of stealing humans blind. And they'll grab your tools. And so you will find Neanderthal remains that are recent, not ancient. Only those that show up 30,000 to 40,000 years ago, where their tools that are associated with them are very slightly more advanced than what they were before 50,000 years ago. Interestingly, we see no evidence that they were using any of the, or even stealing, any of the more advanced human tools that existed. We don't see axes, we don't see shovels, but we do see better scraping implements. And so I think the best explanation is they stole them from the first humans. But their ability to use them was no better than what they had previously before that. And so then that begs the question, why did God create these different species? Well, the thing you notice is there's now a catalog of 12 different bipedal primate species that exists from 6.5 billion years ago until about 30,000 years ago. And if you count Homo forensis, 18,000 years ago. But really the evidence is putting Homo forensis more in the category of a chimpanzee than a bipedal primate. But what you notice is each successive species is a little better equipped to hunt bird and mammals than the previous species. And the thing we notice is that when human beings invaded Australia, within a few centuries, they wiped out 86% of the large-bodied bird and mammal species. For North America, it was 73%. For South America, about 79%. And which really explains why, on those three continents, civilization barely got off the ground. They were lacking the animals that God gave us to launch civilization. If you wait for my book on Job, it's all in there. How critical the cow and the horse are, for example, and the donkey are for launching human civilization. Well, when the humans came into North and South America and Australia, they wiped all those animals off the face of the geographical map. But I believe God created these different species of bipedal primates to gradually help these birds and mammals adapt to the coming future shock of the super predator that can kill anything it wants. The Neanderthals could not kill anything they wanted. They had to, you know, go after the creatures that were unaware, weak, and diseased. We humans can kill anything we want. And consequently, God, knowing that we would sin and begin to abuse these creatures, prepared these birds and mammals for the coming sin of the human species. All that, too, is in the book, Who is Adam? Go ahead.
Yeah, in the arguments on origins of life, some people who are kind of wanting to stick to naturalistic origin events are calling on a undiscovered law of science that explains how the second law of thermodynamics is put aside for
right.
only a brief time frame in order for the first life to come on scene, and likewise for evolutionary steps to appear in the record, like speciation coming back in after an extinction event, which now science has identified multiple extinction events where all the large life has disappeared, and yet it comes back immediately on scene with repeated outcomes, similar but different dinosaurs from Jurassic to Triassic periods. And across those periods of history between speciation or extinction events, the species seem to be consistent in the record. In other words, not changing over millions of years, then disappearing, then similar ones but different ones coming on scene. So naturalistic science is calling on us to believe in an undiscovered law that will explain how all these species come on scene and how the origin comes on scene. But maybe you could talk about the model of how God, in his consistent laws of this universe, is kind of tinkering in the workshop to bring about the origins of life and then also species as they come on scene. Most of the biblical references for that, and also just commenting on how God doesn't need to operate outside his laws in order to assemble both life and species.
Well, you're on target. I mean, one of the more reputable atheist research organizations is the Santa Fe Institute, and they've been arguing that the Darwinian paradigm is completely flawed and with respect to explaining the origin of life or the events in the fossil record. But they are adamant atheists, and so they're arguing that there are hidden laws of physics that would explain the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective, and different hidden laws of physics that explain the mass speciation events that follow the mass extinction events. Now, in terms of how the Darwinists are reacting to this, they're claiming that the mass extinction events are not that extreme. And so they're trying to argue for tepid events as opposed to extreme events. But that's becoming less and less popular because the astronomical evidence is quite overwhelming that the mass extinction events are devastating, and particularly devastating to life forms that are bigger than 1 centimeter across in body size. So, and you're right, I mean, what we see is a mass extinction event followed by a mass speciation event and then tens of millions of years with no change. Then you get a new mass extinction event, completely different species that replace those that existed before, and they continue to exist without change. Similar to what we see with the bipedal primates. Yes, these different species existed, but once they're on the face of the Earth, we can't measure change over a period of time. And the Santa Fe Institute has pointed out that this is devastating to any Darwinian model of evolution. The problem with the hidden laws of physics appeal is how can you hide those laws from the discovery of probing astronomers and physicists? One of the requirements for life to exist in the universe is that the universe must be extremely homogeneous and uniform. So extremely homogeneous and uniform, it eliminates the possibility of an adequate hidden law of physics to explain the origin of life, for example, or these mass speciation events. If such a law exists, we're going to see it on the imprint of the universe, and we don't see any such imprint. In fact, if such laws existed, it would rule out the possibility of a planet like Earth ever being formed. And so our planet Earth requires the non-existence of these exotic laws of physics. So that would be a way to respond to the speculations of the Santa Fe Institute. On the other hand, they're to be commended for pointing out the inadequacies of the standard Darwinian explanations. The latest one I'm hearing from the atheist community on the origin of life is they're appealing to the fact that we can actually put together amino acids into somewhat long chains that could lead up to proteins if we use mineral substrates. And it's true, there's one experiment where they show over 40 amino acids linked together on a mineral substrate. Now, to get functioning proteins that can do anything, you need thousands and tens of thousands, in some cases, of amino acids linked together. But the real problem with this mineral substrate theory is once you get more than 10 amino acids on the mineral substrate, nothing can get it away from the substrate. It's like a glue. It's like super glue. Once the amino acids are attached to that mineral substrate, you can't pull them off. And if you can't pull them off, they're useless for any kind of origin of life model. So my colleague, Fuzz Rana, has written articles on our website dealing with that latest speculation for naturalistic origin of life. Okay, go ahead.
Yes.
By the way, we're down to 10 minutes, so let's try
real
to
quick,
keep things brief. Go ahead.
Genesis, 1,400 years before Christ. Job, maybe 1,000. How can you give me we believe what you said, that Job predates the creation in Genesis. Now, if Genesis was 1,000, and 1,400, and Job is 1,000.
2,000.
Okay. Can you give me a statement or a chapter, one verse in Job that would predate Genesis account?
Well, the evidence that Job must predate the writing of the book of Genesis is the fact that you have a patriarchal system of worship in place. By the Mosaic era, you've got Aaronic priests that are doing all the sacrifices. But what you notice in Job does the sacrifices on behalf of his family. And so that was the patriarchal system that existed before the giving of the Mosaic law. And then you notice that there's no references to historical events amongst competing nations. It's like the nations hadn't really developed to that degree yet. And so the lack of politics anywhere in the book of Job tells us that this must be previous to, say, the 15th century B.C. Another piece of evidence scholars have pointed out is that the entire book of Job, except for a few sentences in Job 42, is poetry. Moreover, the poetry is structured in such a way as to be easily memorized, which is exactly what you would do if you were producing a piece of Holy Scripture before the written language existed. You'd want to put it in a form that could be easily memorized so that you could preserve the content of the book over hundreds of years. Whereas what you notice with Genesis, most of it is written as prose and is not written in a way that can be easily memorized. And so, you can look at the book of Job. It's not that difficult to memorize the entire book word for word. And so that would allow it to be, that's exactly what you would do if you didn't have a written language. You laugh. Nobody in his right mind might do that today. But if you didn't have a written language, that would you do? And the truth of the matter is, in the Islamic culture, they make it a real point to memorize the entire Quran word for word. And the book of Job is a lot shorter than the Quran, and it's more easily memorized than the Quran. So the fact that it's set up that way, again, would give us an argument that it predates. Then the place names that you see used in the text also give us evidence that it predates the book of Genesis. And by the way, that's been a consensus amongst Bible scholars for the last 1,000 years, that Job significantly predates the content of Genesis. But, and again, from my perspective, it explains the things that Moses leaves out. I mean, why would there be these huge holes in the physical creation narrative unless there was other content that the readers of Genesis could rely upon? So, and incidentally, I've run into skeptics who say the Bible can't be the Word of God because of all of that it leaves out. And what they're referring to is all the stuff that is left out of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. The response to that is, read the book of Job, and all these gaps that you complain about are filled in the book of Job. And the bottom line is, what sets the Bible apart from other holy books or religions of the world is that it has over 2 dozen accounts of creation. If you look at the Quran, there's only 3. The Mormon texts have 4. 2 they plagiarize from the Bible, and 2 they add. But the Bible has over 2 dozen. And I think that's partly there to help us deal with our creation controversies. Notice when people in the church get all steamed up about creation, they only look at one account. But if you look at all the accounts, you can resolve the heat of these creation debates from a biblical perspective, to some degree anyway. Go ahead.
This is a follow-on to your comment about finding matter out in empty space. The Voyager spacecraft has recently crossed over the heliosphere, heliopause. Ed Stone gave a talk on this at the Caltech not long ago. And the question is, with all the instruments we have aboard these Voyager spacecraft, do we have any hope of maybe finding some of this ordinary matter that you're positing out in empty space?
Probably not. I mean, as you're aware, the instrumentation on board the Voyager is fairly limited, and it does not contain the instruments that we would need to have any hope of picking up a detection of these exotic particles. But you're probably aware, too, that Carl Sagan had a hand in designing that instrument, and there's actually a message on those Voyagers for extraterrestrial aliens in case it gets that far. So, yeah. Go ahead.
Regarding the origin of life, one of the overarching issues, as I understand it, is where does the information come that's embedded in DNA and other parts of the cell? And is there any other explanation for how this could have originated except from an intelligent source? And if there is any other explanation, is the evidence growing stronger for an intelligent source or weaker?
Well, my colleague Fuzz Rana wrote about this extensively in his book, The Cell's Design. I think we got copies over there on the table. And he points out that the information argument must be crafted carefully, because the way it's usually crafted is people looking at the probabilities of putting together proteins from amino acids. And Fuzz's point is there's so much we don't know about the three-dimensional structures of these proteins and the different possibilities for different three-dimensional structures that we, as Christians, we need to be careful not to push that beyond the limits of our ability to map these molecules and the mathematical calculations of what the real probabilities are. So atheists, for example, will strongly dispute the probabilities that Brent Hoyle developed. Now, we still believe the probabilities are so much against a naturalistic explanation that, but you know, Fuzz is right. We do not have a really accurate probability. All we do know is that it's extremely remote. Remote enough that it's going to pose a problem. But what Fuzz does in his book, he says there's a lot more to the information issue than meets the eye. For example, we see how the information in the cell is organized. And it's organized in such an optimal way that optimization by itself screams for the involvement of a supernatural creator. So he points out, for example, that the alphabet system you see in the amino acids with 20 different letters, compared with the alphabet system you see in the DNA and the RNA, which is four each, but it's not the same four. They have 3 plus 1, and then 3 plus a different one compared to the RNA and the DNA. And what he points out is those three different alphabet systems are optimized to reduce the possibility of error propagation when you begin to assemble these molecules within the cell. He also points out the way that they're assembled in the cell minimizes the error propagation. And for those of us who've had to deal with cancer, it actually helps minimize the development of a cancerous cells, the way it's all designed. And you can read the book. He basically says there's 10 different facets to the information argument, and where you get a very compelling case against an atheistic or a deistic or a theistic evolutionary explanation is when you build a weight of evidence argument, where it's not just one, but you add the second one, the third one, the fourth one, the fifth one, etc. Anyway, the book is a little bit challenging to read, but definitely a great tool to help you in trying to share your Christian faith with educated skeptics. And you're telling me we're out of time?
We're out of time. Can you close us in prayer, Hugh?
I'll close us in prayer and invite you to come tomorrow, 154 West Sierra Madre Boulevard. We'll be meeting there from 7 to 9. If you've got some friends or associates you think might enjoy this kind of a discussion session, please bring them. With that, Father in Heaven, we want to thank you for the privilege of living in the 21st century, a day and an age when the record of nature is expanding at such a terrific clip. Thank you, Lord, that you're giving us additional evidences in these days that help break through the barrier of the increasing pride that exists within our own hearts and the hearts of others. So, Lord, I pray that you would continue to use these new advances in our understanding of the record of nature, as well as our understanding of the 66 books of the Bible, to illuminate our hearts, that we may more fully receive of your truth, life, and love. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.